Welcome back to the Barry Capital Startup Sales Podcast. I'm Evan McElwain, Barry Capital's Director of Growth. And this week, we are joined by Scott Lees, CEO and founder of Scott Lees Consulting and Surf and Sales, to talk about iteration and early stage selling. Great to have you on the show, Scott.
Thanks for having me, Evan. Excited to be here.
Great. So, Scott, tell us a little bit more about your background and what you're up to these days.
Yeah, I spent the better part of the last two decades building and scaling early stage startups. Specifically, my niche has been taking companies from zero to 20, 25 million ARR or so. And then I kind of move on and do it again and move on and do it again. So I did it five out of the six times I was ahead of sales. I successfully got to north of 20 in under 3 years. It's usually like 2.5, 3 years, and slowly started building up my own consulting business, and then built Surf and Sales and wrote a book and on and on and on. I've got all these different things going on, and I went full time on my own in October of last year. So that's what I'm up to right now.
And so, for those who haven't heard of Surf and Sales before, can you tell us a little bit more about it and what's that all about?
Yeah, it's a micro sales conference basically, and we were a little bit ahead of our time potentially with everything going on now in the world. But back in 2017, I was in Costa Rica with my family and my good friend Richard Harris's family. And I was kind of teasing him about the sales conference circuit, and that he's got to get on a plane all the time and go to all these places. And that's just like not my scene whatsoever. And I'm like, how come nobody has a conference in a cool place like Costa Rica rather than St. Louis or some, you know, place that the Hilton or the Marriott's are, right? And he said, well, you know, why don't you build one? I'm like, okay, maybe I will. Maybe you should do it with me. And so the whole premise is you take 15, 20 people out of your comfort zone, go down to a beautiful location on the water in Costa Rica, do sales training from like sales and leadership training from like 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., have surf lessons in the morning, have free surf stuff in the late afternoons and early evenings, have all the meals prepared for you, people cleaning up after you, have local surf instructors. So it's just like this combination of a little vacation with a learning opportunity and this deep, intimate kind of networking experience. So it's like a small experiential sales conference. And once we're able to start traveling and everything again, there's the pent up demand is like through the roof right now. Like yeah. I might end up in Costa Rica for like 2 months straight. Just from, you know, we've hosted four of them and sold all four of them out. And you know, it spawned the Surf and Sales podcast and whatnot. So we're keeping things alive and anxious to get back out there and run.
Awesome, very cool. And Scott, I know you do a ton of content, ton of podcasts. So this one may be tricky, but what is one thing that no one listening to this podcast will know about you?
I'm useless at most things in life. Absolutely useless. Point in case, this, so we've been slowly like stockpiling sports equipment in my house because my kids are big into sports, but we can't go to practices and trainings and whatnot. So I got my younger son a pitching net, and it has 9 different zones, you know, if you are familiar with baseball and pitching. So he opens the box yesterday, and I'm supposed to put this thing together, right? Because presumably I'm the dad, and this is what dads do.
Yeah, it's a dad thing.
Yeah, well, I got like 80% of the way done, and then, you know, 45 minutes later, I'm cursing under my breath at this thing, can't figure out how to tie it off. So, you know, it's jimmy-rigged together right now, but it is not that great. And my wife came out and looked at it and said to my son, I'll help you with this weekend, Caleb. I'll fix it.
Yeah, we'll get this sorted out. That's too good. So we've got a huge topic today, Scott, iteration in early stage selling. Early stage founders are constantly iterating on pretty much every element of their go-to-market strategy. So let's start with the basic, and maybe this is a somewhat obvious question of why is it important to be iterative in your early selling motion? Why are we even talking about this today?
Well, because you don't know what works, right? And that's why you're iterative, because you think that you know where the bullseye is, where the target is, but the target is oftentimes moving or shaking or bouncing around. And sometimes what you think was your target audience or your target market or the right price or the right messaging is just off a little bit, right? And so you iterate because you're learning. So, you know, if you and I come up with a product right now and we try to go sell it, and I make 100 phone calls and send out 100 emails today, I'm going to get information back in the form of feedback from my conversations, right? And then I'm going to say to you, look, this particular messaging that we're using is not hitting whatsoever. But everybody that I talk to mentioned this other pain point that we handle and help people with, but we're not really leading with it. I think we should switch our pitch around and lead with this thing that all of these prospects are telling me is really, really painful for them. So that's why, because you're trying to figure out at the beginning, you know, what are we doing? What's the messaging that works best? What's the price point? What's the territory? What's the vertical? What's the right way to run a demo? What's the right way to handle these particular objections? How do we speak about the competition all around us? And you don't know the answer. And in fact, I would argue that you continue to iterate year after year, right? And it's just a really important part of the first few years of a company's growth.
And this may be too broad of a question, but are there any different signals specifically that you kind of listen or look for that indicate where you should focus on in your next round of iteration?
I'm actually looking for the lowest hanging fruit. I'm looking for conversations that go really smoothly. And what is the tie that binds all these together, right? Now, if I'm calling on four or five different markets and I get resistance from four, but I get a lot of heat and a lot of action from one, I would probably eschew calling into all four of these other markets and go deep on this one that I'm getting some traction on and really focus there and try to lock in all this other stuff, right? And see if I can't build real pipeline and close real deals, get lots of learning from there, rather than fluttering around over here, you know, kind of flailing about and struggling and trying to make all these things go. So I want to get real good at one thing first. You know, when I was at Qualia, we sold settlement software to the title insurance industry, and we also sold to real estate attorneys. But I knew nothing about the title insurance industry. Like, most people probably don't know anything about the title insurance industry. It's unsexy. It's boring. It's also different in every single state in the union. There's different rules and regulations. There's no uniform process whatsoever. Okay. It's even different in different parts of certain states like California. So one of the things that I had to do was figure out, is the pitch and the approach the same for real estate attorneys as it is for title companies? And does this approach work in Massachusetts, which is an attorney title state, versus Colorado, which is a title company state that doesn't have lawyers involved in the process? And so we got initial traction and heat in the New England states. And I literally dumped my whole team into the New England states. And we just hammered that particular area, trying to learn, trying to nail it, build pipeline, close deals, right? And we took those learnings and those testimonials and case studies, and then we went down to Florida, which was very similar, a title attorney state, right? And said, okay, these things worked up north. I wonder if they'll work down south, also in an attorney title state. So I moved away from the sweet spot, but not too far. And we just kept kind of moving like that until we slowly covered the whole country, right? And so I'm looking for these heat signals. I'm looking for not laydowns, but like the lower hanging fruit, right? I need momentum. I need confidence. I need results. And all these early wins from the sales org, that forces the rest of the organization to level up as well. If I'm bringing in new customers, the CS team better have their act together and know how to onboard people and make them successful. If we have new customers that CS has onboarded and those customers start using the product and the product breaks everywhere, that product team and engineering team better get their act together and fix all those bugs as fast as possible, right? And if you've got early adopters, in my experience, are a little more relaxed about some of these things not being perfectly ironed out, right? And so that's kind of how I think about it.
Great. That's really helpful. So Scott, in this world of VCs and early stage startups, there's always such a big emphasis on moving fast, moving quickly, you know, go, go, go. When it comes to iterating thoughtfully, you mentioned going after the low-hanging fruit, but how do you think about the balance of, you know, moving on when something isn't working, but also not pulling the plug on something that's, you know, kind of too soon before you have adequate data?
Yeah. And that's one of the problems I run into with my client base now. People jump from one idea to the next after giving it 24 hours to test. You know, making a dozen calls is not enough information to know whether your process and pitch is working. You know, you're looking for hundreds of pieces of data. That's what I'm looking for. you know, so a couple weeks worth of activity with a particular process and a particular type of messaging, that should yield me enough results. A couple days or a couple hours, that's not nearly enough to know whether something is working or not. But one kind of rule of thumb that I thought about is, you know, depending on who you're selling to, you should have some idea of what the sales cycle might be, right? If I'm trying to sell to the IBMs of the world, then maybe my sales cycle is going to be 12 to 18 months. If I'm selling to title companies, my sales cycle might be, you know, 90 days or so. And so I would kind of take the sales cycle, divide it in half, right? And then say, okay, it should, so my sales cycle at Qualia was 90 days. I divide it in half, that's 45 days, that's 6 weeks. I certainly should be able to apply 2 weeks of effort and energy into this particular process and start to see pipeline build and opportunities develop and see kind of the goal line, if you will, or the light at the end of the tunnel. I should see deals on the horizons a third of the way into this test. And so that's kind of how I've thought about it, the math that I use. So, you know, you're looking for hundreds of data points, whether it's emails or phone calls, and you look at those metrics and you look at the things that, you know, are working or maybe more specifically are just not working. And that's when you know, okay, we've got to tweak this a little bit. We've got to change the pricing from $5,000 a month to $1,000 a month because all of our conversations get to pricing and then we get laughed out of the building, things like that.
And so diving a little bit deeper along those same lines and continuing to get kind of more and more tactical here, let's use cold outbound email cadences as kind of like one example to hone in on. So let's say you've got your cold outbound email cadence and you aren't seeing the results you expected. How do you actually start to peel back the different components to figure out which parts to iterate and which to keep? You know, for instance, you might be thinking, are people not responding because this isn't the right ICP and buyer persona? Is email not the right channel? Maybe it's the right channel, but my email copy is just bad. Or maybe it's too early to make any kind of determination. I should just keep this and let it run a bit longer without changing anything. How do you start to kind of peel that back?
Well, I don't really believe in just doing one channel at a time. I certainly am all about the omni-channel approach at once. So I would be making phone calls, sending emails, utilizing social, LinkedIn, things like that, testing video process. I mean, I would be doing all of those things would be baked into my cadences. So by utilizing all of those channels, I then have more pieces of data and I can say, okay, email is working with this particular buyer persona or this particular industry, or the video prospecting seems to be working really well while the phone calls go nowhere. Okay. So we can, you know, wind down the cold calling, you know, using the phone. Mm-hmm. Let's dial up the video prospecting or the social, you know, LinkedIn kind of outreach and touches. So I don't like the idea of doing just one thing. I like the idea of doing all of those things, getting all of that information back and then optimizing for what's working and removing, you know, what's not.
Yep.
Specifically around email, you know, I'm looking for open rates, of course. If there's links and you can track the click-through rate, that would be great. And then the replies and responses, and specifically do those replies and responses turn into meetings, qualified meetings, and obviously on down the funnel, do they get contracts and close deals and that kind of thing. So where does it get stuck first? Did anybody even open it? If somebody doesn't open it, that screams to me only one of two things, like we're going after the wrong people at the wrong time, or our subject line is not great. I don't tend to be somebody who believes that I need to spend 10,000 hours trying to perfect the perfect subject line. I don't think that's what it's about. I think it's about, did I hit the right people at the right time? So was sending an email on Sunday night at 9 p.m. a good decision? Maybe, maybe not, right? So I kind of skew more towards, was this the right industry? Is this the right person that I'm even reaching out to? You know, and then I have this other information from these other channels. So I know people out there spend a lot of time pressure testing and A/B testing, like subject line after subject line. I know. I think you want to tweak it. I don't think you need to spend forever tweaking it. I think you need to pay more attention to, do I really understand the problem that my prospects have, and am I finding ways to articulate value to them And am I reaching out to them at the right time through the channel that they're likely to operate in the most?
Got it. Yeah, I think that makes total sense. You know, going with the omni-channel approach, it's going to give you that much more information and feedback on what's working and what's not, and going to make it that much easier to narrow in on some of the low-hanging fruit you were talking about so that you do know what to tweak and keep iterating.
Yeah.
So Scott, what are some actionable tactics for, you know, leveraging your early prospects and maybe some of the early champions that you've cultivated as part of this iterative journey as you're trying to optimize various elements of your go-to-market strategy? From, at least from my experience, they really do seem to be sort of the ultimate input to help you figure out what's working, maybe what's not working as well, and what should be tweaked. So love to hear any advice that you have there.
I love the idea of forming a customer advisory board. And especially in the early stage, I think companies wait too long sometimes. And then having like a monthly or quarterly kind of cadence and having phone calls and meetings with those folks and getting their input. I absolutely, over the course of my early conversations, say to people, hey, I really would like to do a case study with you. Would really like to do a testimonial. Are you open to that? It's good for us. It's good for you. And utilizing those things early on, getting that social proof and that buy-in. I have seen people give stock options to early customers before as an incentive. Obviously, there's people who give big discounts or even give away the product for free. That can work in some cases. You might, in order to land like a kind of bigger fish, it might be worth it to you to heavily discount or give it away for free just so you can utilize their brand to help you get more customers. But I think what you need more than anything is just this constant communication and this really quick and direct feedback loop. And I just love the idea of having customers, you know, kind of on speed dial, if you will, saying, how's this working for you? What feature is a pain in the neck? The users of the product, what are they telling you? And gathering all that feedback and then delivering it to the product and engineering team saying, hey, this is what we've got to work on. This will help our product be stickier. This will also help me sell better. And so I tend to get involved in that feedback loop of product conversations, I think, more than some sales leaders. That's something I think that people should be more excited about and do more. And I know a lot of first-time early-stage VPs kind of think, well, I've just got to worry about the revenue and this other stuff is none of my business. But I think that's the wrong way to look at it.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's all so intertwined to make the business really hum and grow. I spent some time as a product manager at my previous company, and I think it made me an infinitely better salesperson and kind of teammate to the other parts of the organization, because it just makes you a much more active participant in that feedback loop to make sure that things are really optimized as best as possible. So let's say, Scott, that you're testing out some new messaging, or it could be around a new feature of the product or whatnot. Would you actually, you know, call up someone who is just they've shown themselves as a champion in the product and say, hey, we've got this new idea. You know, here's a couple of different things that we're thinking about. Which one sounds better? And kind of get their live feedback like that. Does that become an input? Is it sort of that hands-on and collaborative? Or what's your approach?
Yeah, for me it is that hands-on and that collaborative. I mean, I was like on a texting back and forth a couple times a week basis with probably, the first dozen or so customers that we brought on at Qualia, which is I keep referencing it, but that's the most recent like full-time operator gig that I had. And so, yeah, I would be texting them and say, hey, I know you guys just rolled this out over there, you know, feedback on the training and the implementation. And I would take that feedback and give it to our CS leader. And then I'd say, look, if anything starts to bust or break or not go as well, like reach out to customer success first, for sure. But if you have any direct feedback for me, things that, you know, you would suggest I do in talking to our team internally, hit me up. And they'd be all over that, you know, as long as I was receptive and got shit done.
Right.
That feedback dies if I'm unable to deliver and all I do is listen.
Yeah, if you collect and there's no action, then that's right. When people stop giving it.
That's right. But I think that, you know, when a revenue leader is actively involved with getting feedback from clientele and prospects and then participating in those conversations with the product and shows genuine interest in the product, my experience is that the product and Inge team get fired up and respond more positively to that, because they feel like, oh, this person really does care about the product and care about the customer experience and all that kind of thing. We want to build a better product for them. So I really do think it has to be that hands-on, and it can't be just, you know, the head of sales. It probably should be the head of CS. We had one of our co-founders who was calling a customers. We had a co-founder who was visiting all of our early customers in office. And this is 2017, 2018, when you could do these kind of things. And he would go on a roadshow, like, I'm going to this customer, I'm going to that customer. I've seen really smart CEOs like Nick Mehta of Gainsight talks about this all the time. Like, you know, how he's on the road and he's talking to his customers all the time, getting that feedback. But the implementation of that feedback, I think, is what ultimately like cements the relationship and wins them over, right?
Yep. Yeah, I absolutely agree. So let's switch gears a little bit and dig into iteration of the sales process itself. And I know you've got tons of experience working with early stage startups on this, helping them create and improve that sales process. Can you maybe just speak to that a little bit and share some of your best practices when it comes to iterating on the sales process itself?
Well, I think it might sound obvious, but you've got to determine, is this an outside sale? Is this an inside sale? Is this inbound only? Is it outbounding? What is the makeup of the sales team and organization? What is that going to look like? Is this something that requires really, really technical expertise? Is this a big, complex enterprise sale where I might need people who've been in sales for a while? Or is this a relatively simple sale and I can hire people who have, you know, no experience or 1 or 2 years of experience? And then the makeup of that team. Am I going to have SDRs and AEs, or is it going to be end-to-end salespeople only? Do I need sales engineers? Do I need sales operations? And if so, how many? Do I need a recruiter, or am I able to do all the recruiting myself? And one of the things that I've gone on record about many, many times before now, and I'll repeat it here because I think it's so important, but I think, truly believe, one of the only reasons that I've had any degree of success is because I don't take a job without getting alignment from my soon-to-be boss that the first hire I make is a head of sales operations. And this is, I'm finding, fairly unique. And I'm surprised that it's so unique, because I, as a sales leader, like, I know what kind of reports I need to look at. Okay. I know what data I need. I know what tools that I probably need. I don't want to spend time in Salesforce building out reports. Like, that's not what I'm here for. I don't need to go vet vendors and onboard the software into the company. I need somebody to do all the technical stuff that is most likely not my area of expertise. My area of expertise is working with and recruiting the right people around me, the right salespeople, figuring out the messaging that's going to make sense, coaching, training, developing, motivating, not all of this technical operations kind of stuff. And I've seen so many VPs of sales just die on the vine at the beginning because they're trying to wear a million different hats and they're trying to succeed at something that is just not their skill set. So my first hire is always this operations person who I can work in tandem with, right? And they'll come to me and say, okay, here's what I'm thinking in terms of all of our stages of the pipeline in Salesforce. And I'm like, okay, well, there's like 25 stages here. This is too many. We've got to shrink it down to a dozen. Throw this out, combine these two. Okay, off we go. Okay, I need to look at these metrics. I want to know how many dials we have a day, or how much talk time we have, or what our pipeline looks like, the length of a sales cycle, these things. Make sure we're tracking. Go build those things. And while they're building those things, I'm working with my team to make sure they understand the product, they understand the industry, that they can pitch it, that they sound competent when they do role plays. And it's really, really difficult to build and scale a sales org without some of those fundamental pieces alongside you. I really feel strongly about this, and I encourage every VP that I talk to try to get a sales ops person in there as fast as possible.
And I think that just hearing you talk about that, it makes me think back to what you said in kind of on the outset is, hey, look, the first step of iterating is just getting your baseline, right? You got to get something in place first, written down on paper, documented, so that you even know what you're tweaking. And so by getting a sales ops person in seat, you start building out those stages in Salesforce or in your CRM, and you start kind of analyzing, all right, where are deals getting stuck? And ultimately that's the information and data that's going to lead to, okay, like everything's getting stuck after the demo stage. We have this huge drop off in our pipeline. Let's kind of, you know, double click into that and get that kind of unstuck.
Yeah.
So I think that that makes total sense.
Yeah. And, you know, in the beginning, a lot of companies have the stage of closed lost, right? Or something with that kind of moniker. And it just sits there. And missing data is what I would call a reason code. Like, why is it closed lost? Did they say no because they've never heard of you, or you're too expensive, or they're already stuck in a contract with so-and-so, or we're missing this particular integration or feature set, right? And not think about those things in the very beginning until you start to receive some of this data and information, and you start to get some of those things in. And that's when you say, okay, we need to build those in. I need to be able to look at all of these things and give that information to other people in the company so we can improve our process.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think especially, you know, nowadays, it's, in my opinion, it's never too early to start implementing some of the stuff. There's plenty of off-the-shelf CRMs like HubSpot that are free to, you know, if you're a one-person, you know, team that's just getting something off the ground, to start cataloging and documenting some of these deals and why they fall through the cracks or say no. Because what always happens is 2 years go by and you end up being like, why didn't we sign those accounts? What was that all about?
I think a lot of people don't start their work as a head of sales with scale in mind. Like, they think, okay, we just need to get some traction and I'll worry about scaling later on. And one of the things that I think that I've done well is I start building from day one for scale straight away, right? And so that's why things matter so much to me. Like, okay, let's build out this industry training doc. Let's build out this product training doc. Let's get my pitch out of my head and onto a piece of paper, right? Because I'm not thinking about how can Scott be successful. I'm thinking about how can rep number 45, 46, 47, 50 that I hire 2 years from now, how can they have the same institutional knowledge that I have or that other people will have had who've been here for 2 years? And I think more people need to go into it thinking about it that way. How will this work at scale? I have multiple clients who are like, well, you know, I know how to do that. We just do it like this. And I'm like, well, nobody else in your organization who's going to start today has that information that you have. Where are they going to get it from? Because you've never got it out of your head and onto paper, right? And
so totally.
It's that thinking of, will this work for other people 6, 12, 18 months from now, not just will it work for me right now today? And that's what's needed, necessary, and there's not enough of that going around.
Yeah, 100%. It's something we emphasize heavily within our portfolio companies. And, you know, if you get sort of V1 of Scott's pitch or of Scott's industry overview on paper today, just think of how good V10 is going to be in 2 years' time when you're onboarding that 50th rep. Just like we're talking about iteration and go-to-market, it's also you're iterating on the best practices and training that you're passing along to one another internally. So Scott, let's shift back to this relationship between sales and product that we alluded to earlier as it relates to iterating. So we talked before on sort of how you kind of narrow in on what to tweak, going after low-hanging fruit. One thing that I, just from my experience and a lot of the early stage founders struggle with when things aren't clicking is this question of, is it a product market fit problem? Is it a go-to-market fit problem? There's also this kind of all too easy excuse that early reps sometimes use of, hey, this product just isn't good enough. It doesn't have X feature. It's the product's fault that I'm not closing more deals.
Well, I'm going to give an answer that may not be what you're expecting or hoping for, but is in fact the reality in many cases. And that is, if you have accepted a sales role, it doesn't matter if the product is not up to snuff yet. Your job is to figure out how to sell it and bring in customers. And so at the end of the day, like, it's on you. It just is. And whether that is fair or right or wrong or whatever, you should have vetted that a little better beforehand. And I made that mistake. I have one blemish, I would say, on my resume, and I screwed it up. I didn't vet the product good enough, didn't vet the founders good enough, and I paid the price for it. Mm-hmm. Every other place that I've gone, always there is early feedback that says, oh, you don't have this, you don't have that, right? And my salespeople are like, oh, we're never going to be able to sell this. Yes, we are. We just have to keep kind of grinding. We've got to work and tweak our messaging a little bit, right? And we've got to deliver information to our product team that these are the things people want. But you've just got to keep the faith, I think, number one, that your product does solve a very real pain point and a very real need. And you've got to just keep tweaking and keep putting up the volume and not get discouraged. And if you're surrounded by a team that responds to your feedback loop of customers are asking about this particular integration, I'm hearing it over and over and over. And if their response to you is, well, forget about that, we're never going to build that, that's a red flag for me. If the response is, that's super helpful information, we need to look at that in terms of our, you know, release cycle and scope that out and see, that's a good signal that you're a part of a team that's going to be responsive and receptive to the feedback.
So if I'm hearing you right, it's if I'm a founder trying to figure out if these deals aren't closing because of a product market fit issue or a go-to-market fit issue, it kind of comes down to what is that close loss reason? And is that reason something that's tied to my go-to-market? Like this is the wrong ICP and buyer persona, maybe it's the price, it's too expensive, or is it because we don't have a certain product integration or something that's much more kind of product focused? Is that kind of the right way to think about it?
Yeah, you've got to give them information. You got to have the reasons. Otherwise, you are going to be in this no man's land of like, well, I don't really know. Is it the product or is it my pitch?
Right.
If I'm tracking these things and I have 50 customers this week who told me, well, I can't work with you because it doesn't integrate with Salesforce, that's a product issue that we need to solve, right? If I don't hear those things and people's reason to not talk to me is just, oh, we're not interested, that's a sales issue. That's a messaging issue. That's a process issue that has everything to do with your pitch and your outreach, has nothing to do with the product whatsoever, because the conversation hasn't even gotten to the point where you're really talking about the product yet.
I haven't even seen the product yet.
And you know, salespeople love to have the excuse, well, there's something's wrong with like the product or what we're doing because nobody will even let me have a conversation. Bullshit. You haven't had a chance to talk about the product yet. You can't blame the product yet. The only person to blame so far is you. And
right.
and your sales leader who maybe hasn't helped develop the right kind of process and messaging yet.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So another question that comes up, Scott, is when working with early stage founders and things are lean, it's a small team, there's always this question of, you know, what can or what should we outsource in the go-to-market strategy, if anything? So I'd love to get your opinion on outsourcing part of your go-to-market strategy as an early stage company. Let's use an outsourced SDR firm as an example. If you're struggling to get prospects from the top of the funnel, have you found that that approach can actually help speed up the iteration process, or does it actually slow things down because you're now kind of one step removed from that feedback loop?
I think it's a little bit role and topic specific. I am not a fan of outsourcing SDR teams because of what you just said. It slows down or removes the feedback loop. I also just kind of fundamentally think, well, those people are kind of more mercenary-like, and so they're not going to fight as hard, you know, or be as passionate about what we're doing. So I don't know if it's the same level of like effort, if you will, that's going into it. A couple things that I think do speed up the process is, you know, working with leads and acquiring leads to talk to. I mean, unless you have some way and you know how to scrape the web in some way to get all the leads that you need, I don't think it's an effective use of your time to slowly source leads yourself, or even worse, have the sales reps be sourcing leads. I don't want my salespeople spending any time sourcing leads. I want them to show up, sit down, and boom, everything is in Salesforce and ready to roll in Sales Loft or Outreach or whatever I'm using. So I would certainly outsource that. And the other thing that I would say, and this is becoming more and more common with all the portcos that I talk to and the VCs that I work with, and that is this fractional CRO, fractional VP kind of mode. Hiring the right VP of sales for the right stage of your company is really, really tricky. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And you can combine bringing in somebody who's done this multiple times before and they can help you figure out this playbook and this messaging and setting all this foundational stuff up properly. And if they're really good at what they do, they probably also have a really big network. And utilizing that network can can bring you recruiting benefits. So now all of a sudden I don't have to also outsource my recruiting and pay an executive recruiter 50 grand to find a new VP of sales and 5 to 10 grand to pop to find an AE. Like, this may sound self-serving because this is what I do, but there's a lot of other people out there like me who I see now adapting to this and becoming a part of this kind of this structure, because now I can help 5, 10, 15 companies at a time. And now Evan can help 5, 10, 15 companies at a time. And it's much more cost effective. And you think about spending 50 to 100 grand maybe over the course of a few months to get all of this set, this stuff set up right, to get some early wins and early data under your belt, to also bring in your permanent leader, also bring in a few early team members. The ROI is massive, because if you set those things up right, the money that you spent is nothing compared to the millions that you've increased your valuation. So I think more and more companies are doing this like fractional VP of sales, fractional CMO kind of role, and outsourcing the leads. Lead acquisition is good. And I know people do the outsourcing of AE teams or SDR teams. Maybe it's just the like control freak in me, but like, I want control over my sellers who are sending out the messaging, and I would keep those in-house.
Got it. Yeah, I think that makes complete sense. And we've also seen that play out well at some of our portfolio companies, bringing in a fractional CRO just to help with some of those elements as you were talking about just then. Well, Scott, we've talked about pieces of it today. You've obviously had one hell of a sales career yourself, both as a sales leader and operator, now in this consultant and advisor to multiple startups. What's one thing that you wish you had known starting out that would have saved you a whole lot of time and headaches along the way?
Oh my gosh, one thing. There's a million things. I probably would have swung for the fence a little bit more. I sort of strategically at the time went for organizations that I felt like, okay, I can get this company's valuation to like 250, and then they're telling me that they're going to sell, and like we can have some, you know, smaller nine-figure kind of quick flips and whatnot. And I had those. But here's the thing that I wish somebody would have told me. You're going to work just as hard for that couple year period of time for a $100 million exit as you would for a $1 billion exit. And I didn't optimize for that enough. And I really wish that I had. I never do go back and work for somebody else. I'm not going to go work for a company that I think is a, you know, nice little nine figure acquisition. Like, I'm going to swing for the fence, because the amount of time and energy and effort I spend is going to be the same. So I'm not going to kill myself for 2% of a $100 million company. I will kill myself for a 2% of a $1 billion plus organization, because the reward, if you will, is so much larger. And nobody told me that, and I wish they would have.
Yeah, that's great advice. It's the same out of work. You may as well optimize for that higher reward. Well, Scott, we've covered a ton of ground here. Are there any final thoughts, tips, or tricks that you want to leave folks with to summarize?
Yeah, one thing that we didn't touch upon that is a mistake that I see all the time founders make is when they think they've got the fundamentals and the basics in place, they hire one seller to test it. That's not what you want to do, right? If you've ever hired salespeople before, you know, even the best who've hired thousands of salespeople in their career over decades get it wrong quite often, all right? So if you bring on one person, you have no way of knowing if the reason it's not succeeding is because of that particular individual, as opposed to the process and the you know, playbook you put in place. So I hire in three. When I first get started, I tell everybody, hire three reps, because one of them is liable to be really good. One of them is probably going to be kind of average, hits quota most of the time, sometimes doesn't, which is very normal. And one of them is probably going to suck. And I will learn what I need to do moving forward as I hire from the makeup and background and experience levels and differences of those three particular individuals. So when I went to Qualia, for example, I hired somebody with an SMB background, somebody with an enterprise background, and somebody with no experience whatsoever, because I wanted to see, you know, which kind of bucket is going to be right for me to grow this sales org. Well, it turned out the person with enterprise experience crashed out, and the other two folks did quite well. So I now optimized for non-enterprise level experience as I moved forward. And I'm really glad that I operated that way. So if you're looking to pressure test your sales motion for the first time, I really encourage, don't just hire one person. Hire a couple people. Make those people, you know, metaphorically sit next to each other, learn from each other, share notes, compete against each other. And that process will tell you a lot more information than just having one person.
Great. Yeah, I think that's a really great kind of lesson and note to end on. Well, Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show and chatting with us on iterating during a sales process. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, man, it's been great. And come back to Thursday Night Sales anytime, Evan.